Space is another issue. Our use of space is culturally determined. One of the most difficult things about living in another culture, particularly a developing world culture, is that they don't have physical space. When I lived in St. Lucia, there were 8 to 10 people who lived in a house with 1 or 2 rooms. 6 or 8 people would sleep in the same bed. Children saw everything. I had a friend who was teaching kindergarten in a school where the majority of our population was Haitian. And she got married during the year, and one of the little Haitian girls said to her, "Well, Miss Tamargo, do you know how to make babies?" And Tara thought, "I think I need to say no to this because I want to see what she's going to say." And the little child says, "It's very easy." She said, "You get up on a table, you lift up your legs, and you just go, and it will pop out." Now, my friend Tara said, "It was not like that at all." But what had that child seen? She had seen a great deal of birth because it was a part of her experience. Our perception of our world is often determined by the spatial vistas: mountains, plains, ocean, jungle, skyscrapers. Our concept of personal space, both needed and wanted, varies from one culture to another. So, in our culture, personal space is very important. In many cultures, it is not. And we oftentimes feel like people are invading our personal space. But that is simply because they don't have that same concept. And we just need to understand that. We can create, spaces that we say, "Please don't cross this line." And we can do it in a nice and accommodating way, recognizing that people aren't trying to invade our space. It's simply that they don't have an understanding of that personal space. Our use of personal and public space varies. I was working in one diocese with Hispanic ministry, and we were called into a parish that had had a 50% Mexican population and 50% Anglo population for years, and they got along beautifully together until a new pastor arrived. He had been in the army for 30 years, and he knew that everything had to be run on a schedule, and he had to run a very tight ship. And so he made up all kinds of artificial rules. If you were going to use the parish hall on Saturday, you had to sign up 3 weeks ahead of time in the blue book on the left-hand corner of the secretary's desk. Well, of course, everybody knew that the Mexicans used the hall on Saturdays, and so the Mexicans never thought to sign up in the book. Until one Saturday, the pastor came in with 2 or 3 people he wanted to have a meeting with, and he found all these people there. And he immediately began yelling and saying, "Don't they know how to follow rules?" Well, by the time we were called in, there was a real standoff between the pastor and the Mexican population. When we sat down and discussed what had happened and about the underlying values that people were operating out of, both sides realized that they could accommodate each other. Okay? Our sense of time, I don't have to spend a lot of time on that because we're accustomed to the fact that we operate on different times. In many countries, time is not nearly as important as it is in our country. We tend to operate on clock time. Others tend to operate more on cyclical time. We use, interpret, talk about, and think about time very differently. We simply need to understand that and not become angry when people don't make the 10 o'clock appointment that we have scheduled. The idea of the individual versus the group is also a really important one. Our culture is a very individualistic one. Again, if we think of a continuum with individual at one end and group at the other end, our culture values individualism very highly. Other cultures simply do not see that as a value. They value the group over the individual. So when we work with people from cultures for whom the group is important, we need to take that into account. For instance, when I was teaching high school and I would have many Mexican students in my class, and I would see a child who was very bright, I would say immediately to myself, "I would really like to see Maria go on to college." But I knew that to simply go to the family and say Maria ought to go to college because she's so bright would not convince the parents of the need for that, because their need was for Maria to help out the family. And Maria herself would feel that way, that she would have a responsibility to go to work to help the family. So I learned to go and sit down with the parents and say that if Maria had the opportunity to go to college, she would be able to help the family far more than if she simply went to the fields to work. And we would list the different ways of doing that. And they could understand that. When I was working in Guatemala, many of the children there, particularly the girls, did not go on beyond fourth grade because the parents felt that was all they needed. And at that time, we had a program from UNICEF, and I was asked to work with the local teachers to help the parents to understand why it was important for the girls to go on to school. And so the program was called Eduquemos a las Niñas, We Must Educate the Girls. So I sat down with the local teachers and we came up with a series of skits. So we went up to the aldeas, and in the one skit, I was the parent, and Steve, who was 6'4", was my daughter. And we addressed him up in a corte and huipil, just for some light comic. And the other two teachers, one was a Ladina and one was a Mayan teacher. And so in the little skit, I was sweeping the house when my son comes home, Armando. And he's going, oh, why, mi estómago me duele mucho, ¿qué puedo hacer? I'm going, ¿qué puedo hacer? Mi hijo está muy enfermo, no sé qué puedo hacer. And I'm saying, I don't know what to do, my child is hurt, my child has a stomach ache. And I call my daughter, who prances in his little corte and huipil, and I say, go find the health promoter. Now, each of the aldeas had a health promoter, so they knew what that was. So he goes off, and the Ladina teacher comes in. And she says, well, did you eat or drink anything differently? And I said, no, I gave him the same foods. And he says, no, Mama, when I was playing soccer, I drank from a puddle. Well, she knew immediately that he needed the rehydration therapy. And so she gave it to him, and he was fine. And I said, how did you know to do that? And she said, because I went to sixth grade. So we could say to the parents, you see, if your daughter goes on to school, she will be able to be a better wife and mother. That the parents could understand. Last year, I received a card from that community. And in that community now is a high school located down on the river. A number of the aldeas go to it. 55% of the students graduating from that high school are now girls. Okay, now that's been over a 15-year period, but it has totally transformed the culture. So the concept of the group we need to keep in mind. Oftentimes, people who operate out of a group consensus will bring their children to everything. At the school I was at in Florida, when we had parent education classes, I knew they were going to bring the children. So we anticipated that ahead of time, and we had something for the children to do. They oftentimes have loyalty to their groups, and we need to understand that as well. Our ideas of work and leisure are very different. Having lived in the Caribbean for many years, I think they have a much healthier lifestyle than we have. It's not work, work, work. You work to survive, and then you enjoy life. And so we do have different attitudes. We oftentimes call that laziness. It's simply that different things are valued. If we value relationships, we spend more time with other people. Okay? And so as we move into a global marketplace today, we have to understand that there are different attitudes about work, different attitudes about leisure, different attitudes about sports and games. Okay? Our relationships are formed, maintained, and valued in different ways in different cultures. People date, marry, and divorce for different reasons and in different ways. When I was in college, we had a student there from India. And one evening in the dorm, she said to us, I'm getting married this summer. And we were really excited for her. And we said, well, tell us about him. What's he like? And she says, I don't know. I haven't met him yet, because she came out of a culture that still adhered to arranged marriages. Of course, we were like, how can you marry someone you don't know? That's terrible. And she simply looked at us, and I'll never forget her answer. She said, you Americans, she said, you marry for love, but you fall out of love as fast as you fall in love. She said, in our culture, The purpose of marriage is to learn to love. Very different value. Okay? We need to understand today that there is no such thing as a typical family. Okay? We have often, many of us have grown up in a nuclear family, mother, father, children. Today, families take many different configurations, and many of the people that we work with have large extended families. Okay? The role of women is different cultures, is different in different cultures. I may not like the way women are treated in another culture, but I need to understand where they are coming from in that culture. Another important aspect of culture is power distance. This is how far we see ourselves from having power in a given society. And so some societies operate out of a rectangular model where there's an upper class, a lower class, and a large middle class, but the possibility to move from one class to another. Other cultures are triangular. There's a small, powerful elite at the top, but the majority of the population is at the bottom and is oftentimes less educated. And many of the people that we work with come out of cultures where they have not had a lot of opportunity to impact the culture itself or to impact the power structure. And so they oftentimes see us as the authority. And when we ask what they think about something, they oftentimes don't have an opinion because they don't think it really matters. We need to understand that. Think of our typical modus operandi in our parishes. When we need help with something, what do? We ask for volunteers. Well, if you come out of the rectangular model, you freely volunteer. If you come out of the triangular model, you would never volunteer, because you don't see yourself as having anything to offer. However, we can compensate for that by asking people directly. We may not see ourselves as being people in power, but those with whom we are working do see us as authority figures. And so, for instance, in a parish, if we're having a festival and we want volunteers to cook, we might put an advertisement in the bulletin and ask for people to provide some foods. But we also might go to specific people that we know in the parish and say, Griselda, I know you make wonderful tamales. Would you be able to make some for our parish festival? Now, Griselda would have never answered the ad in the parish bulletin, but she is absolutely delighted to contribute because I have asked her. Therefore, I recognize that she has something to offer. We need to keep that in mind when we're working with people. They may not be able to express what it is they need. We have to ask some probing questions sometimes, and we have to help them to understand that they do have something to offer, they do have something to contribute. This is extremely important when we're working for systemic change, because we are trying to change the structures in which people live. And therefore, we have to help them to understand that they truly do have something to offer. They don't just have to be the recipients of aid, but they can participate in their own development. Okay? We can choose to live in different kinds of spaces. If we choose ethnocentrism, we are choosing to live in a room full of mirrors, where we only look at those people, those places, those objects, those situations, which reflect back to us what we already know. However, we can also choose to live with ethno-relativism, which is a room full of windows. When we live in a room full of windows, we're able to look out and to see multiple different ways of doing things, and to recognize that rather than suppress us or make us feel like we are unworthy, it truly helps us to see that we are part of something much bigger than ourselves. The other day, I was at a meeting at the UN of an interreligious group, and we simply sat around and we shared our different traditions around the holiday seasons. And so in the group, we have a Shinto priest, we have Zoroastrians, Buddhists, people of the Islamic faith. We had a Wiccan practitioner. But what was wonderful about the experience was that people listened to each other and we learned about each other's practices and traditions, and no one passed judgment. If we're truly going to engage in systemic change, we need to respect the people with whom and for whom we are working. We need to recognize that they come out of a world and with a worldview that is very different from our own, but also has tremendous possibilities, tremendous gifts, new ways that we can come to understand the many, many different ways God chooses to manifest His presence, her presence in this world. The world in which you were born is just one model of reality. Other cultures are not failed attempts at being you. They are unique manifestations of the human spirit, unique manifestations of the God whom we all choose to worship in different ways, with different words, with different cultures, with different rituals, but a God who loves and embraces all of us.